I'm Andrew O'Hagan, host of a new podcast from the London Review of Books. It's about the bloodiest and most controversial event of the Falklands War, the sinking of the General Belgrano. Margaret Thatcher was accused of a war crime. The truth would only emerge in the pages of a private diary. This is the Belgrano Diary. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
You're listening to the London Review of Books podcast. My name is Thomas Jones. Today I'm talking to Rachel Nolan, who teaches Latin American history at the Pardee School of Global Studies at Boston University, and has a piece in the current issue of the LRB on the 1954 coup in Guatemala and its aftermath. The piece is a review of Mario Vargas Llosa's most recent novel, Harsh Times. Hello, Rachel, and thank you very much for joining me.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
We'll get on to Vargas Llosa in a bit, but let's begin with what happened in 1954 with the events of the coup. And maybe you could just talk us through what happened.
Sure. So the 1954 coup in Guatemala is an event that I'm always surprised people haven't heard of, because it's even somewhat funny if you aren't a Guatemalan whose government was overthrown, of course. So what happened in 1954 is that Guatemala was a tiny Central American country that most people in the United States had never heard of. However, it had overthrown decades of sort of semi-feudal dictatorship in 1945 with the opening of what was called the Democratic Spring or the Guatemalan Spring. So Guatemalans had open elections and elected presidents freely and fairly for the first time. However, this grew to concern the United States because one of the democratically elected presidents, Jacobo Arbenz, began a systematic land reform. And this wouldn't have been an issue, right? A small Central American country undergoing land reform. Why did the United States care? They cared because one of the largest corporations in the United States at that time was United Fruit, which made an absolute boatload of money by shipping bananas in to the United States and around the world from various Central American countries. They were known as El Pulpo, the octopus, because they had their tentacles in every aspect of Guatemalan economy. So they controlled the railroads, they controlled the electrical system, et cetera, et cetera. And they had generally enjoyed enormous political influence in Guatemala. So when the land reform came around in 1952, the United Fruit said, no, 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 this will ruin our business, absolutely. And so they hired a publicist who happened to be Sigmund Freud's nephew to kind of promote the idea in the United States that communism was infiltrating Central America and that it would become some sort of Soviet beachhead that the Soviets could use to interrupt U.S. control of the Panama Canal and then eventually, you know, reach up into the United States itself. And this was a time of anti-communist paranoia. So the nephew of Freud didn't have to do an enormous amount to convince people in Washington that Guatemala represented a threat. And the CIA at this stage was very new. It had just been created out of its predecessor organization, and they had collaborated with MI6 in the overthrow of the Iranian government just the year before. So the CIA, young, fresh, enthusiastic, thought, well, you know, we found this new, very cheap, very handy way to combat international communism, and we'll just go in and overthrow the government of Guatemala. Why not? And in fact, they found a kind of would-be dictator sloshing around in Honduras. He'd previously attempted coups and not succeeded, in part because everyone in Guatemala hated him. So there's no way he ever would have successfully brought down the government in Guatemala were it not for the logistical and financial support of the CIA. The CIA, it's kind of incredible. You have these documents, internal documents from the CIA, which have since been declassified, that describe how they were doing psychological profiles of various candidates for Tin Pot Dictator. And they settled on this one individual, Castillo Armas, who I've just mentioned, who was hanging around Honduras hoping for his chance, and, you know, pumped him up with money, with mercenaries, with, importantly, bombers. And in 1954, Castillo Armas entered Guatemalan territory. He would never have had a chance militarily against the Guatemalan government, but the CIA also engaged in a kind of radio scare campaign that was inspired by Orson Welles' fear broadcast. Historians are divided about how successful that radio campaign actually was. But what we do know is that Arbenz was spooked into resigning. And in fact, he did resign, sought asylum in the Mexican embassy, and Castillo Armas successfully took over the government of Guatemala. So that's the kind of not so short version of what happened in 1954.
And that question of it being, I mean, there are many pretexts, but the idea that it was sort of a beachhead against communism, or to prevent communism establishing a beachhead on the America, in the Americas. I mean, it's partly true, but in a sense what the land reforms were, I mean, the plan was to give land to landless peasants. And in a sense, that could be seen as a capitalist move in a way. You're creating more property owners. And obviously they were taking land from United Fruit. And I think you mentioned in your piece that the value of the land that they were prepared to pay for it wasn't the actual value of the land, is this right? But just the amount they declared for tax, which is obviously much lower. So they were sort of caught out by their own fiddle there. So the CIA told this story about it being anti-communist. I mean, Arbenz wasn't communist, was he?
No, Arbenz was never communist. And one of the fascinating and horrifying aspects of this coup is that the United States really shot themselves in the foot. What they were looking for long term was a stable, non-communist Guatemala. And in fact, allowing land reform to continue probably would have been a safer path to that desired future than meddling in the Guatemalan political process in the way that they did. And just as you say, limited land reform probably would have been a more effective anti-communist measure than the measure that was taken by the CIA. What's important to understand is that there was a lot of anti-communist hysteria globally at this time. The Communist Party in Guatemala was minuscule. There were 3,000 to 4,000 members in a country of several million. One of the reasons for panic was that one of the members of the Communist Party was an advisor to Arbenz. So it's not as if there was no communist influence whatsoever in Guatemala at this time. However, as that communist friend of Arbenz famously said, they would have overthrown us even if there had been no bananas. That's a direct quote from this communist friend, in the sense that, yes, it was the business interests of United Fruit that helped cause the coup in 1954, because that certainly captured the interest of a lot of important players in Washington at that time, who, by the way, were members of the United Fruit Board, or who were seeking, who were shareholders, or who were kind of seeking connections with United Fruit. It's kind of like the connections between Silicon Valley and Washington now, right? There's a kind of rent seeking that we would call corruption in a Latin American country, but is just sort of institutionalized in the United States, so we consider it legal. However, the kind of anti-communist hysteria was such that even 3,000 members was 3,000 too many members of the Communist Party for the United States at that time. The interesting thing is that even the CIA, with their limited intelligence, was cognizant of the fact that limited land reform could be an anti-communist move. They pursued that in other parts. The U.S. pursued this in other parts of the world, including East Asia at the same time. And in fact, at first, when the CIA was doing those psychological profiles, thinking, who would be the best dictator of Guatemala? They were hoping for someone who had, you know, would continue land reform, or who was in favor of land reform, and for the exact reason that this would have been effective against the communists, right? But the CIA eventually concluded that that was basically too muddled. You couldn't overthrow someone who was in favor of land reform and then sort of prop up a new dictator who was also in favor of land reform. Also, strategically, it was never going to work, because the natural allies for the CIA in this coup in 1954 were local elites in Guatemala who were rabidly anti-communist. So I don't want to say that the kind of right-wing paranoia was all coming from Washington. There was plenty of it on the ground in Guatemala. And so the sort of far-right elements in the military, the Catholic elite, there was a rabidly anti-communist archbishop at this time. And so it was going to be very difficult to find a sort of moderate puppet dictator. So they went for a ferocious kind of right-wing puppet dictator.
And he didn't last very long, did he? That Armas was himself, he was assassinated, what, in 1957?
That's right. Castillo Armas lasted barely 3 years. The other thing that's important to know about him is that he was, as the CIA themselves admitted, a political non-entity. I mean, he was a terrible choice. He was uncharismatic, skinny, a terrible sort of Hitler-esque mustache. I mean, he was unpopular, unprepossessing, not very smart. I hate to pile on to Castillo Armas, to whom history has not done particular honor. Even the right wing in Guatemala has a hard time sort of defending him. They found other heroes in earlier parts of Guatemalan history.
We talked a bit about the CIA making up. They were making up a lot of stories here. They were making up stories about, as you say, with the radio show that was imitating Orson Welles' War of the Worlds and dropping the leaflets. And they were able to convince Arbenz to quit through telling these stories. And then they were telling an anti-communist story at home. And they also told themselves a story that this was an incredibly successful covert operation that nobody realised it was the CIA doing it. When in fact, everybody knew it was the CIA doing it. And they only convinced themselves of this, that they'd done it in secret. Is that right?
That's absolutely right. And one of the fascinating things about reading the historical accounts of the 1954 coup is the extent to which the CIA believed their own lies after the coup. The 54 coup went down in CIA lore and training for decades as a success, as far as we know from the CIA's own internal documents, right? And so they convinced themselves, we did it. You know, the director of the CIA famously said when he heard that Arbenz had resigned, bully, bully, we did it. Meaning it was an utter success. It depends how you measure success, however, because in the longer time scale, what happened in Guatemala after 1954, a group of military officials felt so humiliated by what everyone knew to be a CIA intervention in the country and all over Latin America that they took to the hills and they formed the first guerrilla groups that helped begin the complicated civil war starting in 1960 that lasted until 1996. So Guatemala saw the longest and the bloodiest conflict in 20th century Western Hemisphere. The civil war that lasted from 1960 to 1996 saw 200,000 people killed, the vast majority of whom were Mayan indigenous people, and I can get into that, although that's a sort of later history. Many of the disenfranchised peasants who would have benefited from the land reform were themselves indigenous. So that was the group that was later targeted in the genocide that unfolded in the 1980s as part of this greater civil war. So what's the connection between 1954 and the civil war? Even the Truth Commission that was backed by the United Nations after the Civil War to kind of say, hold on here, what happened? How did this conflict begin? They trace the beginning of Guatemala's political instability and the sort of tinder that lit to ignite the Civil War in 1954. They trace it back to when the United States overthrew the Guatemalan government. So there's a direct link between the events of 1954 and the instability that led not just to Castillo Armas' assassination, because I hate to say it, but who cares, but to the kind of cycle of assassinations, new dictators, and the guerrilla forces that were founded by some of these disillusioned army officials, but many peasants or people who had no access to land or resources or recourse of any kind started joining those guerrilla movements, fueling the civil war throughout recent Guatemalan history. And frankly, the country is still devastated by that period.
And beyond Guatemala as well, presume. I mean, because you can see this, if this was the first US-backed coup in Latin America, and the CIA was convinced it was such a success, and then there are countless stories overthrowing Allende in Chile, and the whole history of the US intervention overthrowing political left-of-center political moderates and replacing them with fascist dictators, that Guatemala was the model for that.
Absolutely. And so I don't want to overstate the extent to which this was totally new. Of course, the United States had been sending Marines, invading, influencing all over Latin America since before the independence period. However, what started in 1954 that was so new was the CIA, the idea that this was going to be covert. Covert in heavy air quotations, because of course, published even before the coup in Guatemala in 1954, it was all in Guatemalan newspapers that the United States is involved, this is going to happen, the invasion is coming, etc. So it was covert only in the United States, right? In Latin America, everyone knew it was the CIA. But 1954 in Guatemala did set a model for covert interventions all over Latin America. And the fascinating thing is it's not just the success, or tragic thing, is it's not just the successful interventions that you mentioned, 1973, Allende being the most famous. It's the unsuccessful ones. Bay of Pigs, you know, the CIA was coming out of 1954 in Guatemala, which is, I maintain, I know that my personal hobby horse is Guatemala, but I maintain it's much more important than people give it credit for. Because coming out of Guatemala in 1954, the CIA thought, we have this cheapo, super successful way to overthrow a government that we don't like. Let's do it to Castro. And they hired back some of the same mercenaries from Guatemala to participate in the Bay of Pigs fiasco. What happened in Cuba is that the cards didn't fall their way in quite the same fashion. As we know, it failed spectacularly. But the idea was one and the same.
And the other Cuba connection, right, is that Che Guevara was in Guatemala at the time of the coup.
Sure. So Che Guevara was a young man at the time of the coup in Guatemala. He was hanging around Guatemala City with a kind of band of lefty exiles from all over Latin America. He met his first wife in Guatemala City. She was a Peruvian economist, very interesting in her own right. And Che was in Guatemala to study the land reform. He thought that it was one of the most promising redistributive programs in Latin America at that time, and he was right, and he wanted to see how it was going to unfold. What he witnessed instead was this unbelievable backlash, and like everyone else in Guatemala, Che was very clear that the United States was behind the intervention. He was very disappointed that Arbenz, the democratically elected president overthrown by the United States, didn't call on popular militias. Che was ready to grab his gun and, you know, fight off the imperialists, but no popular militias materialized. So he was forced to seek asylum in the Mexican embassy. And then he later was granted safe passage to Mexico, where he met Fidel. And when they began plotting the Cuban Revolution, it was Che, according to many accounts, many historical accounts, that helped convince Castro, you know, I saw the intervention in Guatemala firsthand. We need to be prepared for a U.S. military intervention. We need to be prepared for covert action. By many accounts, including by his first wife, who met him in Guatemala City at the time, Che was radicalized by what he saw in Guatemala. And there's a question in, there's a kind of historical question about whether the course of the Cuban Revolution would have been different had Guatemala not unfolded the way it did in 1954, had the U.S. been less heavy-handed or decided not to get involved at all in 1954 in Guatemala.
I mean, the ramifications of that go everywhere. They go to Angola, to, I mean, across the world. The idea that if the Cuban Revolution had played out differently, or if the history of the Cold War, the whole of the history of the second half of the 20th century would have been quite different.
And in fact, Fidel didn't announce himself as a Marxist-Leninist until 2 years into the revolution. It's not as if he took power and said right away, I'm a Marxist-Leninist, we're affiliated or we're aligned with the Soviet Union. He was, even with the advice of Che in his ear, he was looking for some kind of more independent path. And then Bay of Pigs and other, you know, U.S. threats arguably forced him into a more radical Soviet-aligned position. Again, this is a matter of intense debate among historians, Cuban historians, foreign historians who write about Cuba. But it's a fact that Fidel didn't announce himself as a Marxist-Leninist until 2 years in. So that creates some really interesting historical counterfactuals, as you just mentioned.
This is the LRB podcast. If you enjoy listening to it, you'll probably enjoy reading the London Review of Books. To subscribe from just £1 per issue, go to lrb.me/listen. That's lrb.me/listen. Or click on the link below.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
You mentioned in your piece Stephen Kinzer and Stephen Schlesinger's classic history of the coup, Bitter Fruit, and the CIA's classified account of its operations in Guatemala. So what does Mario Vargas Llosa's novel, his fictionalized account, bring to the story that isn't already there in the history books?
That's a really good question. Vargas Llosa, since the 80s, has been writing historical novels. And he has, to give credit where credit is due, a real talent for choosing the juiciest moments in Latin American history to write about. So he wrote a fabulous novel about, called The War at the End of the World, about a kind of religious fanatic uprising in Brazil in the late 19th century. He wrote, of course, the famous novel, The Feast of the Goat, about Rafael Trujillo, the dictator of the Dominican Republic, and I can mention many more. So of course, as someone who has lived on and off in Guatemala for a long time, who writes about the history of Guatemala, I was delighted when he chose the 1954 coup. There's a feeling of, oh my God, he's noticing this tiny country that is, I think, is so important. And that, of course, Guatemalans rightly think is the key to understanding the whole region. But the question remains, what does he add by fictionalizing it? And in fact, if you read Harsh Times alongside Bitter Fruit by Stephen Kinzer and Stephen Schlesinger, alongside The Secret History, which was written by Nick Culleter, which is the internal CIA account of the coup in 1954, you think, oh my God, some of these details seem awfully familiar. And in fact, the Bitter Fruit is so well written that he didn't have to fictionalize very much. So Vargas Llosa, in his historical novels at his best, creates a kind of fascinating interiority for historical characters that you cannot have in nonfiction. So The Feast of the Goat, for example, you have a kind of access to both Trujillo and his enemies' internal states that he couldn't have lifted from any nonfiction account. Harsh Times is not as good a historical novel as The Feast of the Goat, unfortunately. So he really misses the opportunity, in my opinion, to further fictionalize what sort of remains nonfiction on the page often. So for example, just think about the choice of the characters that he inhabits. Castillo Armas was a mediocrity. It's not interesting to be in his mind, unfortunately. And the much more interesting person in the history that Vargas Llosa could have entered into more fully is Jacobo Arbenz himself, the democratically elected president of Guatemala, who was overthrown by the CIA. What was inside of his decision to step down? Did he have some kind of mental breakdown? Vargas Llosa includes the fact that he was drinking alcohol at the time, was trying not to drink alcohol. His father had died by suicide when he was a young man. So there's a lot of sort of interesting things to fictionalize there. And Vargas Llosa sort of misses the opportunity. Arbenz appears early on in the novel and then drinks a glass of whiskey and sort of drifts off and you never hear from him again. And that would have been an interesting character. So there are some missed opportunities there, I think. The most interesting character is the lover of Castillo Armas, by far. And she's a great character.
She's based on a real person, but there's a lot of invention. I mean, he calls her Miss Guatemala, right? Which she wasn't. Presumably that title maybe didn't exist at the time. I don't know.
That's exactly right. The lover of Castillo Armas is based on a real person. So she is a historically existent person. In fact, she still is alive. She lives in South Florida. She tweets. She has a blog. She is an ardent Donald Trump supporter. And there is a afterword to the book in which Mario Vargas Llosa visits her and they have a conversation. And it's clearly, I'm sure it's thinly fictionalized. He changes the location of her house, for example. But she says something to him at the end of their conversation, which I suspect might be drawn from real life, which is she says, "Don't bother sending me a copy of your book. I won't be reading it, but my lawyers will." And so I love that. And I don't know if she actually said that, but it sounds true to who she was as a person.
And thinking about the comparison with The Feast of the Goat and the missed opportunity with Arbenz, because there is that the character in The Feast of the Goat, the general who was part of the the coup that overthrew Trujillo, who is meant to then step in and say, I'm in charge of the country now, and who's paralyzed, and he knows what he's meant to do, and yet he doesn't do it. I mean, he's one of the most amazing, memorable characters in that novel, so it seems not to have... Ardbenz would be the equivalent character, I guess, in this story.
He would be the equivalent character in the sense of someone who's experiencing psychological, you know, uncertainty, doubt, anything that might interest a novelist, rather than a military invasion, which is, of course, of interest to historians, but has less interesting internal stakes. The other comparison that I'll make to The Feast of the Goat is to say there are many characters in that book who are not important historical actors. For me, the most interesting character in The Feast of the Goat is the young at the time of the Trujillo dictatorship, daughter of one of Trujillo's ministers. So this is not someone who appears in most historical accounts. And she's given this very convincing, very interesting interior life. So I was thinking, what would the opportunity have been in Harsh Times? Basically, what was the opportunity that I feel that Vargas Llosa missed? And I think he missed the opportunity to think about someone who benefited from the land reform. I mean, one of the things that as a historian you don't have access to, and for a novelist or for a reader of novels would be very interesting, is someone who was a peasant, someone who had received land. And that, can you imagine working on someone's plantation, the kind of patron, the big boss's plantation for decades, your family being effectively indentured or even enslaved to that family, suddenly receiving a tiny parcel of land in 1952, and then in 1954, as soon as the land reform is reversed, having that land snatched back from your family? I mean, what kind of experience was that? So like a young kid in that family or anyone like that, of course I would love to read that fictional account. But, and this is where Vargas Llosa's politics perhaps come into it. We haven't mentioned them very much yet. Vargas Llosa is very interested in power. He's not so interested in the peasant. He's not so interested in the view from below, as historians would perhaps call it. So the Urania Cabral, this character in The Feast of the Goat, she is not herself powerful, but she is the daughter of a powerful minister under Trujillo. And so Mario Vargas Llosa's politics in real life are quite conservative, are quite right-wing. He's criticized in Peru for not understanding or taking into account the indigenous or the peasant point of view. And so I wonder, despite the fact that his novels have a kind of lefty sensibility that is often at odds with his right-wing political writing, you know, his nonfiction writing, his columns for El País, I wonder if you can't smell a little bit of his political sensibilities in his choice of characters for these novels.
Now, that's really interesting, because it's the thing that's so often said is if the politician, you know, when he ran for president of Peru in 1990 on a neoliberal platform, privatization, austerity, the politician, he should read these novels by this guy Mario Vargas Llosa to give him a different point of view. And that's what's usually said. So that, yeah, but to say that actually the novels, there is more continuity between the fiction and his avowed politics than you might think is, yeah, that's quite persuasive.
I think so. So on the one hand, that's my reading. And of course, when Vargas Llosa was a candidate, one of his biggest supporters was Margaret Thatcher. On the other hand, Harsh Times received this sort of divided reception in Guatemala because the right wing was expecting a sympathetic account. And in their view, a sympathetic account is Guatemala was about to go communist. Castillo Armas saved us from becoming another Cuba. So Vargas Llosa's much more historically based account, which freely and openly says Arbenz was never a communist, land reform was capitalist, it was intended to bring Guatemala out of its sort of feudal land relations into a more modern capitalist society, was viewed as a betrayal by the right wing in Guatemala. So there's a sort of interesting, he's neither fish nor fowl in that sense.
Yeah, and as a young man, he was very much of the left, wasn't he? I mean, was he a Marxist-Leninist? Maybe not Marxist-Leninist, but he was Marxist?
You can't be a university student in Latin America at that time and not be reading Marx, at least. He says that he was very attracted to Marxist-Leninist philosophy and that only later did he turn right-wing. He says, again, to give him the fair accounting, he always cites the repression of writers under the Castro regime as a kind of turning point for him and the imprisonment of homosexuals in that country, et cetera. So there are some reasons that he gives for taking a kind of rightward turn. And his former best friend with whom he had a dramatic break, Gabriel Garcia Marquez, the other extremely famous writer of The Boom, the Colombian writer, went in exactly the opposite direction. So after the two faced off, in famously Vargas Llosa punched Garcia Marquez in the face in Mexico City. No one ever knew what that was about. Maybe it was about a woman, maybe it wasn't. But they diverged politically even before that. And Marquez became very close with Castro, and Vargas Llosa veered increasingly to the right. So this is a kind of famous split in the Latin American novelist intelligentsia.
But, I mean, as a right wing, he's a liberal in economics, and he's a libertarian and a social liberal. So, that I mean, it definitely is a move to the right. I suppose, I mean, these labels, they mean different things in the US and the UK and Latin America, but he would never have aligned himself with Pinochet, for example.
No, of course. No, one needs to be fair to Vargas Llosa. However, in recent years, he's been writing some sort of disturbing things in El País. He wrote that allegations of political fraud in Peru and in fact, the ombudsman of El País had to retract it, saying that there was no evidence that there had been political fraud. He has been writing things. I think he was nervous because of this candidate who just won in Peru, Pedro Castillo, who is Marxist aligned. And Vargas Llosa seemed to go crazy and say, you know, Peru will soon be another communist country. The new version, the kind of new version of the old Cold War, instead of saying, oh, we'll turn into another Cuba, as if this were the worst thing possible, now right-wing elites in Latin America say, oh, we'll turn into another Venezuela. And so that's what he was saying.
And that worldview which he has, which is shared by a lot of people who describe themselves as liberals in the US and in Europe. I mean, I guess there's a sense in which he would see himself as a realist, and the idea that believing in moderation and the middle way, the third way, and this kind of thing. But he's at the same time, he's very interested in people he perceives as utopian fantasists, I guess. And we see that in The War at the End of the World, that this millenarian cult, this real millenarian cult in Brazil at the end of the 19th century, and even in something like his novel Aunt Julia and the Scriptwriter, somehow the way that alternates those two stories between the narrator, who's describing his sort of, well, in a sense, real world affair with his uncle's wife, and that's intercut with these increasingly elaborate radio soap opera stories that his friend, the scriptwriter, is writing, and the friend eventually ends up in a psychiatric hospital, if I remember right. So he seems to be very interested in this kind of mad, as he sees it, utopian thinking. But at the same time, is there something kind of utopian and slightly mad about his ideas? The idea that the way to confront this fascist dictatorship is by, I don't know, returning to the ballot box with moderate reforms, and it can be done. And actually, that's utopian thinking as well, isn't it?
That's a really, I had never thought about it that way. That's a really interesting way of putting it. He does seem fascinated with utopias and people who are mad enough or interesting enough to dream other worlds. And so you think, well, why, when he ran for president or when he's fulminating about politics now, does he seem so tethered to quote-unquote reality, austerity measures, things that have poisoned the lives of so many people in Latin America for so long? And then I like your turn, that it might be a sort of utopian thinking instead, to think, well, we'll just try the old thing and hopefully it will work this time, instead of, you know, trying to imagine a more equitable or egalitarian world. That's maybe going too far, and that's for my novels, and we'll remain with this very depressing reality for my politics. Thank you very much. Honestly, he's a split man. That's one of the things that's so interesting about Vargas Llosa. Even his not very good novels are interesting because of that dual consciousness of the world, in a sense. His historical novels and his non-historical novels use the same technique of sort of intersplicing different moments in time, different kinds of conversations. And one of the marks of a great writer is that you can follow it. I mean, Harsh Times, you are moving back and forth between the lead up to the coup, the aftermath of the coup, the aftermath of Castillo Armas' assassination. For someone who is not a, you know, a paid pedant in Guatemalan history like myself, I did think, would this be easy to follow? And then I thought, oh yeah, of course it would be, because I am less well-versed in the kind of historical context of other novels that he's written, but I was able to follow them perfectly. The Feast of the Goat is a great example. He jumps all over the place in terms of time. That's set in the 90s, it's set in the 60s, it's, you know, it's all over the place. But you can follow it, and there's a certain kind of through line and even telenovelistic tension, right? Telenovela being the soap operas of Latin America. There's a kind of soap opera-ish quality of a lot of what he writes. There's the unrequited love. There's the sort of mystery that will be resolved in a later chapter. And that's part of what keeps you reading across these quite fragmented little bits and pieces. And then, of course, I think that The War at the End of the World is one of his great masterpieces. And so you know what's going to happen because it's a well-known historical case. But the tension of waiting for it to happen is almost unbearable. And I will say, in that novel as well, it really pays to read the nonfiction account, because there's a character in that novel, the journalist, who is a famous Brazilian journalist who wrote Rebellion in the Backlands, which is the famous historical account of what happened in Canudos, this event that he published in 1904 that's still in print. And it really pays to go and read Da Cunha, which is this original account. That's the original journalist, and see how much Vargas Llosa lifted, but also just enjoy the account, which is, you know, totally expressing all of the prejudices and the worldview of a 1904 journalist who was himself not from the backlands. However, is a great read. There's a reason that it's still in print. There's a reason that it's a classic.
Do you want to quickly say what the situation was that story tells for people who don't know it?
Oh, sure. So in the 1890s, Brazil had set itself up as a sort of fragile republic. And there was a religious fanatical leader who was going around gathering followers in the backlands of northeastern Brazil, which is the historically black and impoverished part of Brazil. And he was a monarchist. And he's called the counselor in the novel, and so it's easier to refer to him as that. And he was a monarchist, hoping that the Portuguese monarchy would be restored. But most importantly, he created this ferociously loyal band of followers who, when the Brazilian army decided that this kind of separatist monarchist group represented a threat, the army had to go in not once to raise this group to the ground. They resisted so ferociously, not twice, but three, four times. I think it took four efforts to destroy this community. And eventually the counselor was killed. Many of his followers were killed. It's rumored that some of the women who survived were taken to brothels in Salvador de Bahia. But this is the most important civil war, really, in Brazilian history. And it's an event that's well known in Latin America, not just because of the bloodiness of the conflict, but because of the sort of utopian religious manias of the leader and the fact that he was so convincing to a large number of people. So when I say that Vargas Llosa has great taste for choosing historical events to write about, I mean it. I mean, this is one of the most fascinating events in Latin American history. I would put the 1954 coup in Guatemala up there as a similarly fascinating event. I don't think he gives as good an account of it novelistically, but his choice of topic is impeccable.
I mean, it's interesting the way he ranges apparently so comfortably across the continent. I mean, there was the thing that, I mean, I presume it's true, this story that when Ronald Reagan went to in 1982, he met the president of Guatemala, Efraín Ríos Montt, in Honduras. And afterwards, he apparently said, I learned a lot. You'd be surprised. They're all individual countries. There's this idea that, which is also that you mentioned earlier, this idea that, I mean, it's all too believable of Reagan. But the way in which the Vargas Llosa, who's Peruvian, but writes so comfortably ranging across the whole continent, slightly Reaganite view.
That is a slightly Reaganite view. I mean, on the one hand, you're right about all the individual particularities. And he's very good on some of the particularities of the countries that I know well. And I would assume that the countries that I know less well, he's really done his research. I remember I was in Guatemala when Fox News in the United States referred to the three Central American countries, Honduras, El Salvador, and Guatemala, as the three Mexican countries. And everyone in Guatemala was sort of up in arms thinking like, wait, but we're sovereign nations. So on the one hand, every Latin American, of course, recognizes national sovereignty because it sticks in their craw when no one else recognizes it. On the other hand, Vargas Llosa, clearly as part of his research process, goes out of his way to, you know, get to know intellectuals, writers in the various countries that he's writing about. He thanks people who have helped him do research in Guatemala quite fulsomely in the acknowledgments of the novel. So it's not as if he does what journalists would refer to as parachute journalism, where he just comes in for a couple of days and then heads out. He's been doing research in the library of the Francisco Marroquín, which is one of the right wing, by the way, universities in Guatemala. He appeared on stage. The interesting thing is, it's not just that he's good on the details of all of these particular countries. He's also politically engaged in the national realities. So when he gave the book presentation in Guatemala City, he appeared on stage with Jacopo Arbenz's son. He appeared on stage with the son of the overthrown the president that was overthrown by the CIA. So he's clearly trying to make a kind of political point as well as presenting a novel. And he's very, you know, he knows that his novels will be received that way, but he's also very conscious of that. And so that's an interesting choice.
And a slight risk of doing, well, exactly that myself, and I'm talking about other countries. But the way that the consequences of the coup in 1954, that Guatemala is still living with them, and that there was the civil war and that followed, and the US interference and continuing interference in Latin America, which continued long after the end of the Cold War. And in recent years, that the ousting of Manuel Zelaya in Honduras in 2014 or of Evo Morales in Bolivia in 2019. When you're reading the novel about the coup in 1954, does it have echoes with those events?
Absolutely. Just to be clear about what's apples and apples and what's apples and oranges, the U.S. supports two flavors of coups in Latin America or globally, right? Still, there are two flavors. One flavor is we do it, the do-it-yourself coup, where the CIA pays for it, hires people, does central casting for the tin pot dictator who's going to come later. And that's the 1954 coup in Guatemala. The second flavor of coup is to give the green light. The CIA does not support the coup directly. They don't give the money. They don't send the mercenaries. But they tell the plotters, we will support you if you go through with this. And because the United States, and that's the classic one, is Brazil. I mean, there are many cases of this, right? The CIA in Chile in 1973, it's a little bit of a mix of the two categories now that I've set up the two categories, because they were funding right-wing student groups. But the coup itself directly, they gave the green light. It's not as if, as in Guatemala, they were sending the bombers overhead. So it is important to kind of separate them out, because I don't want to say everything is the CIA at all times in the same way. And so recently, the flavor that the CIA seems to have been preferring is we'll give the green light, and then as soon as the coup is complete, we will recognize the new government without creating any problems internationally, either at the UN or at the Organization of American States. And so that's what happened in Honduras, for example. And Hondurans were furious that this did not come up more frequently during Hillary Clinton's presidential candidacy, because she was the Secretary of State at the time who gave a rubber stamp to the outcome of the coup. And so what the role of the CIA was at that time, what the role of the embassy was, you know, we'll have to wait until those documents are declassified. But it's a fact that the U.S. turned a completely blind eye to the coup in Honduras, with the result that we have ended up with a narco state in Honduras, who is still considered a close ally of the United States. And so as we speak today on Monday, November 29th, there has just been an election result in Honduras with some promising possibilities for an opposition candidate. But the current president of Honduras, Juan Orlando Hernandez, is a drug trafficker and has been indicted. His brother was indicted in Brooklyn court. His name has been mentioned over and over again. Of course, the lawyers would want me to say he denies all allegations, blah, 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 which of course is true. But there's no question that Honduras is a narco state. Whichever way you look at it, it walks like a duck, smells like a duck, et cetera, et cetera. It's a narco state. So what the U.S. is willing to accept as an outcome of their so-called successful coups continues into the present.
And also that there are huge numbers of people fleeing Honduras, in particular among other states, but I mean, vast numbers of the people who are stopped at the US-Mexico border are fleeing Honduras. And that creates political problems to the United States. So it's not, I mean, it's kind of unclear how this is, how it's in the US interest. Why, what is it? Why, how is it in the US interest to support J-O-H.
There's an activist slogan that was coined in the UK, actually, by members of the Windrush generation saying, "We are here because you were there." Meaning, if it weren't for the colonial and sort of post-colonial meddling, we wouldn't be migrating to your country in ways that perhaps make you uncomfortable. The same could be said of Central America. So the really historic change in the so-called immigration crisis at the U.S. border is that up until kind of 2000, the vast majority of people coming to the U.S. were Mexican. Post-2000, and certainly in the last 10 years, the vast, vast, vast majority of people trying to migrate to the United States are from Honduras, El Salvador, and Guatemala. Think about the U.S. intervention in each of those countries, in Guatemala and El Salvador, backing right-wing, first of all, the coup in Guatemala in 1954, destabilizing the entire country. And then during the civil wars in El Salvador and Guatemala, backing brutal right-wing dictatorships that massacred vast swathes of people, when they fled to the United States, no one's asylum claims were recognized because Reagan was behind all of it, right? And then Honduras has a different story. They were the big allies of the U.S. U.S. air bases were set up in Honduras during the civil wars of the 80s. But in more recent times, we have been supporting people like Juan Orlando Hernández. So it shouldn't be any surprise to anyone in the United States that huge numbers of Hondurans are showing up at our doorstep. And there are a lot of push factors, right? There's gang violence, which under conditions that the U.S. has also helped to create because of drug demand in the United States. There's climate change, there's gender violence, there's all kinds of stuff pushing people out of these countries. But the political instability, you really do have to trace back to the United States if you have like half a brain and one eye cocked for the history books.
Rachel Nolan, thank you very much.
Oh, thank you so much for allowing me to ride my preferred hobby horse, Guatemala, with you here today.
You can read Rachel Nolan's piece in the current issue of the LRB, along with Perry Anderson on Stella Gervas's Conquering Peace, Colin Burrow on Isabel Williams's new translation of Catullus, and A Diary by Bernadette Wren. The LRB podcast is produced by Anthony Wilkes. The music is by Kieran Brunt.